Is I'd like to talk for a little while. It's kind of the same format I used yesterday morning. And then spend hopefully half the time. We can have some discussion or you can ask questions. And the questions have two functions. One is that you can ask your questions or make your comments of what's important. And maybe I can reply best I can. But also it gives me a chance to hear what's on your minds, what's on your hearts, your concerns you might have. Since I haven't been here much for at least 4 or 5 weeks now, I think, it's nice to kind of for me to get a little bit in touch with you. And also since you've had a lot of teachings all summer, for all July from Taraniya, she told me there was not a lot of discussion. Maybe there was, but she told me there wasn't. And so maybe it's nice to hear if you have any comments or questions around anything that's come up. So what I want to talk about is a little practice or a little attitude that has periodically is very important for me as I do my meditation practice. Many of you know that in our Vipassana practice, one way of doing it is to make mental notes to help you stay in the present moment with your experience. We make little notes or mental notations, labels in the mind, of what we're doing, what we're experiencing. So I can, since I'm paying attention to the fact that I'm talking right now, I might note to myself, talking, or seeing, hearing as a truck goes by. And that's a great help because, as we know, the mind wants to slip off the present moment endlessly. It doesn't want to stay there often. It's like the present moment is like this sharp, you know, razor's edge, it's often said. And mostly the mind wants to roll off the edge to the past or into the future. And the label is like an anchor to the present moment. At certain points in my practice, I found that the label that I liked using the most was I labeled everything the same. And my label was yes. Yes. So the attitude or the practice of yesing, I want to suggest to you that maybe there are times when you want to try that out and it can be helpful. Today I went to pick up my son at his preschool. I have a 4-year-old son. And preschool is an amazing place. And preschool teachers are my heroes. Probably one of the most important professions going. Underappreciated. And the first thing I heard walking in through the door of the preschool was, nothing's permanent. One of the teachers was telling the group of kids very raptly sitting around the table listening and engaged in their snack. But it's also very humbling for me to go to the preschool because I realized how little I know about human nature. And, it's such a challenge, So I show up there. Before I walked into the classroom and heard that little expression, there was all the kids and everybody was inside except there was one little girl outside with her father. And they had a kind of distance between them. I couldn't quite understand the distance, but then I got closer. I saw that she was in tears. It was dramatic. I mean, it's like, this is serious. I mean, it's like, if it was any normal person, like an adult, her fiancé would have broken up, or she would have, been rejected from Stanford, or someone had died. It would have been something really serious. And this poor girl, is going through this, tears and cry, and her father was keeping his distance, and she was there. What's this about? How do you relate? How do I relate? This human being who's obviously in terrible distress, the father is there, but you just walk right by. Do you go over there and give her a hug and say something and find out what's going on? And it's preschool. Preschool has this whole context. The teacher's kind of tracking things and know what's going on, and they're very skilled. So what do you do with this? So I said something. I forgot what I said, but I said something very casual as it went by. It was hopefully compassionate or something. And I came through and went in, and then I heard nothing is permanent. And then I learned a little bit later that it was a power play between her father and the girl. And the kind of policy at the school is that if you play with something, you put it away at the end of your play, before you play with something else at the end of the day. And it was the end of the day, her father was bringing her home, and the girl wanted her father to clean up for her. And the father, for his reasons, did not want to. And this was why she was crying. Preschool. So there's a man, another father to one of the kids in the school that is teaches improvisational dance at Stanford. And the kids love him. And for part of his vacation, when he wasn't working, he volunteered at the school. And he does improvisational play, I guess. I guess all play is improvisational for four-year-olds, but he just is right at home there. So I showed up there, and he was already there, and the kids were climbing all over him, and there were like three kids climbing on his back, and some kids like to hit him a little bit, and kind of they have these plastic noodles, you know, that you don't hurt, and they go around, and they play sword, and they were doing everything you can imagine on top of Tony. And Tony was on the floor, and they were jumping on top of him. And they were all having a good time. And then at some point, the kids got distracted by something else, and Tony was laying there. And he's a friend of mine, so I went over to say hello. But he was still laying on the floor, and I said, "Can I jump on you too?" And he said, "Yes." And you know, he had his hands up like this. So I grabbed his hands and, you know, held him. And I wasn't going to jump on him, but then I just helped him up. I pulled him up, and he twisted himself up. And I said to him, "You say yes a lot, don't you?" And he said, "Yeah." he said that some time ago he heard an interview or something on maybe Saturday Night Live with, said Michael Myers. Is that the guy who's... That's the guy, right? That's the comedian? And he was talking about his work as a comedian. And he said that what he learned in doing improvisational comedy is you always say yes to whatever comes your way. You never say no or block what's happening, but you say yes and go along with it and go with it. So then next thing, I was talking to... That really, really, you know, was interesting for me. This attitude of yes to what comes your way. And the last little preschool school story, just from today, you know, a little snippet of 20 minutes. And there's a lot more I could tell you. I can probably spend the whole day, you know, 2 hours talking about 20 minutes in preschool. But there was one of the most beloved teachers there had been gone for quite a number of months and actually left and was coming back and substituting a little bit. And she was back for, this was her second day there. She hadn't been around preschoolers for some time. And she's explained how on Friday when she was there, she was telling the kids a story, but she was out of the preschool mode. And she was just telling a linear story that was very real, you know, all these real things that happened, real time, real space, real everything. And, you know, she had a hard time keeping the kids' attention. And but today she found out that it wasn't so interesting. You know, what was interesting for the kids is, you know, it's an imaginary world. And what she did with the kids was, she spent a whole hour with the kids, which is a long time, doing what's called a board story, where you draw on the board, the chalkboard, the story as the kids relate it. And the kids all take turns, or try to take turns, because they're so enthusiastic, filling in the details of the story they're inventing as they go along. And it was all about a magic bus that goes flying, and teachers are in it, and all the kids in it, and Tony's in it. And, you know, and they go flying around into the past, into the future. And so this idea of taking what comes your way and going along with it, playing with it, building on it, not saying no to it, not blocking it. And that is something I think we recognize from doing mindfulness practice that's very important, is learning how to get out of the way of our experience, learning how not to block it, how to resist it, how, in a sense, not to say no to our experience. And one of the best places I know, safest places in life to not say no to your experience is in meditation, where you don't have to do anything, you don't have to say anything, you just sit there with the experience. And it's quite phenomenal to have a place in life where you can go and you can just let your thoughts, your feelings, your body sensations, whatever, course through you freely. and not feel like you have to judge them as being wrong or bad, or judge them in some way that, you know, or you have to inhibit them or stop them. That it's all allowed in the context of this big container, this sacred container, this beautiful, spacious container of awareness where everything bubbles up and flows and goes. And one of the things we learn is that when we don't interfere with our experience, when we do this, allow it to be there and flow and move through us, and not interfere it, not interfering with it, we stop fueling it, feeding it. Because all too often we feed our experience. And it's the feeding of our thoughts, the feeding of our feelings, which often keeps them in place. So, for example, something very simple like resentment is anger which is frozen. And what fuels or feeds the anger, what keeps it frozen, is the continual reassertion of that holding on to that idea or thought or hurt that we have. If it isn't frozen or we're not holding on to it, the anger would move through us and we wouldn't be so trapped by it. The idea of... So I'll give you another... This is a story I've told a lot, I apologize, but it's kind of another yes story in a sense. The story of the ugly little runt of a troll, of a yaksha. Yaksha is a kind of a minor spirit or god, an ancient Indian pantheon of gods. And he's a little ugly little runt. And he ends up going to visit Brahma's throne. Brahma is the great god of the Indian pantheon, kind of like the Zeus of the Greeks. And he goes to his throne, and he sits on it when Brahma is away from his throne. And all the other gods around say, you can't do that. That's only the highest god can sit on that throne, and this is terrible. And they started getting angry with him and saying, get off that throne. And the more that the gods were angry with Brahma, with the yaksha, with the troll, the bigger he got and more beautiful he got, till he was radiant and huge and strong. And so the gods were kind of confused. And so they went and found Brahma. And Brahma said, I know what to do. So he went back to his throne and stood in front of this yaksha, and he bowed to him, as you do in India, in Buddhism. And he paid his respect, and he said, oh, it's so good to see you. I'm so happy that you're here, and I hope you're comfortable in that throne. And what can I do for you? And as he offered his respect and his kindness, the yaksha shrunk and shrunk and got ugly and uglier, shrunk and shrunk and poof, disappeared. And then Brahma went and sat on his throne and explained. That was an anger-eating yaksha. The only food it eats is anger. And the more anger you give it, the bigger it gets, the stronger it gets. So the idea of, you know, interfering with things involves how we also means how we feed and fuel our experience. And really, one of the remarkable things to discover in meditation is this great thing about how if you get out of the way of your experience and really learn how to leave it alone, it self-liberates. It kind of, the fuel for it it's not getting refed constantly. And it kind of dissipates, it kind of unwinds or resolves itself. So you don't have to be engaged in fixing your experience always. You don't have to be adjusting it and judging it and making it bad or whatever. If it's not meant to be there, it'll dissolve. If it's meant to be there, like the wholesome mind states, like joy and delight and love, it'll tend to grow in the light of awareness. Because awareness by itself tends to dissipate or dissolve the unwholesome states of mind because it doesn't feed them. And there's a kind of somehow a way in which awareness itself feeds the wholesome states, the beautiful parts of us. It's almost as if that beauty within us wants to thrive just when we don't interfere. And it's the interfering which lets the unwholesome things thrive. So meditation is one of those places where we learn not to block what's happening, to interfere with what's happening. But in order for that to be safely done, you have to very clearly and honestly is kind of the main word here, admit to yourself what is actually happening in the present moment. And that can sometimes be the hardest thing. To admit that you're angry or sad or happy or ambitious or, you know, all kinds of things. Admit that you're sitting here filled with sexual lust. I mean, you certainly don't want to admit it to the public, so sometimes you don't want to admit it to yourself. But you have to admit what's going on. And in admitting it, what's going on, that combination of allowing things to be, leaving things alone, and admitting that they're being really honest about it, that's where the safe container of meditation allows our spiritual life, our liberated life, to unfold most beautifully. Does that make sense? So saying yes to the experience doesn't mean, of course, foolishly saying yes to someone who wants, you know, something terrible from you, or doesn't mean you're a pushover for things. But there's a wonderful art, both in meditation and daily life, of learning how to take what comes your way and not putting up a block or a resistance to it, not saying no to it. At the same time, wisely knowing how to take care of yourself, and then kind of going with it, kind of like Aikido, where you kind of go with the energy of it. I've learned a lot of this with a little kid that I have, you know. It's just a drag to kind of say no all the time. You know, you can't do that, you know, you can't have that. I mean, how many times in an hour can that kid say, I want that, I want that, I want that, I want that? Yeah. Yesterday we were, you know, I don't blame him partly. I took him to Home Depot. And I noticed that the I want that escalated the longer we were there. And so I think he was getting pretty frustrated and tired. And it wasn't like he wanted these expensive, you know, items there. He wanted like the, you know, the flyers that are falling on the floor and, you know, just all stuff. But this is constant barrage. I want this. I want this. And I try to tell him, you know, there's more important things in life than having. You know, there's like love and your friends. And I said all that, and then I wondered, you know, uh-oh. Maybe I shouldn't tell him this way, because that's going to give him a bad taste in his mouth for those kinds of lessons in life, you know. But anyway, so, but you don't always, you know, say no to these kids, you know, but you don't want to always give in to them either. You have to choose your battles carefully. And so, but, you know, this wonderful art of learning how to take what comes and saying, in a certain way, say yes in a way that channels that in a way that seems appropriate for the parent or appropriate for the situation. And say yes, you know, and go with it. Not to be in opposition to what's happening. What's happening with your friends when your friends come and talk to you? Is there some way you can say yes or not resist it and go with it? Improvisational friendship, improvisational everything. In fact, probably everything's improvisational we ever do. And one of the rules of improv is you don't say no. So those are my thoughts. I hope they're useful. Let you all decide whether they're useful if you experiment, investigate this topic some more on your own. So now it's your turn. Do you have any questions you'd like to raise or comments?
I thought it was amusing and maybe very helpful that you said to say yes instead of labeling. I find it very difficult to label things by feeling and hearing, or itching or anything like that. I think like feet and truck, and so I've sort of thought that was wrong, but I guess it isn't if you can say yes.
Right. Okay. Oh, so sometimes my mental note is I grunt at things. You know, anything that helps you keep you in the present and going with the experience. But usually I do kind of like, it becomes yes or kind of a grunt when I'm really flowing with the experience. I'm really right there and it's kind of hard for me to actually fall off. I'm kind of in a screw flowing with the present moment. And that's when, for me, the yes and the kind of little grunt seems to work the best to kind of keep me on track. For me, when my mind is not so concentrated and easily slips away, it seems to be more useful to name the experience as it actually is, you know, in some simple way. But, you know, with mental noting, there's no right or wrong, or there's no wrong, and there's only right. There's only what works for you. And don't burden yourself with, you know, some idea of how it's supposed to, you know, what they're supposed to
it just seemed to take a little bit more brain power to figure out which sense is in use. Just easier to think. Feet.
Great. Yes?
I find it challenging when you're with someone else and you realize that there's a resistance to the flow of being with someone else. So I take that technique of sort of labeling or saying something to note that while you're with that other person. But sometimes I guess ultimately once this technique evolves or became good at it enough, the amount of labeling that you do becomes shorter so that you can open to that other person. But I still sometimes feel like it takes me a while to like get to that sense of flow with someone else because I'm so busy kind of labeling, but trying to labeling as a way to diminish certain feelings of resistance or certain feelings of, say, for example, self-loathing or self something that keeps the distance between me and the experience, you know. And I guess I don't know if I'm asking, like, does the amount of time that you label get shorter, or because generally I guess there's no right way or wrong way that something happens, but I don't know. I guess I'm just sharing too.
So the kind of the comment or the question, it was the, she noticed that sometimes when she's with people in conversations or in relationship with people and she has resistance to people, that she uses the mental labeling as a way of helping her work with that resistance. But she finds at the same time labeling keeps her a little bit distant from the person, kind of like a little removed then. And so then the question is, if you keep developing this as a technique, the labeling technique, does it get better over time? Does it get quicker? Does it work quicker? So that the resistance gets dropped quicker, and so there's less barrier between you and the person. You can drop the labeling, I suppose. I think that the mental labeling is. Some people don't like doing it, never do it as part of their mindfulness practice. Some people do it a lot, and some people do something in between that. It can be phenomenally useful, but it's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. That at first is really awkward, and people think that meditation is about having a silent mind, and here you're making your mind noisy by labeling your experience. But it's kind of like riding a bicycle, and once you ride it, you can ride the bicycle without your hands, once you've learned to do it. So with the mental labeling, it becomes almost second nature after a while, and very easy. And it doesn't seem to kind of make much ruffles in the mind, and it kind of keeps you on track. It's easier and easier. But there are ways in which the mental noting can be used. There's times for it and times not for it. Sometimes mental noting, people use it not as a way of more clearly recognizing what's happening in the present moment, but they use the labeling as a protection from the present moment, like a mantra or something. If I keep labeling and naming this, then I won't have to kind of really open up to what's happening. Mm-hmm. And so with something like, you know, resistance, which you don't like, are you really honestly admitting it, or are you trying to somehow balance with it by labeling and kind of keep it at bay or something and hope it goes away? But it isn't I think of labeling as an art form. And you have to kind of try to figure out when the art form should be applied. And if your goal in a given situation is to overcome your resistance and it's helpful, then go for it. If your goal in a situation is to be intimate or close with your friend and it gets in the way, then drop it if you can have a clear flow with the person. So you have to kind of decide yourself what you need, what you most need, what's the greatest benefit, what's the cost-benefit analysis, you know, how to make it work. But there's a shortcut to this in relationship that's really great if you're brave. And that is you label out loud. And I really recommend it. You know, especially you do it with people you really trust and say, you know, I'm sitting here and I feel all this resistance to you right now. I feel irritation right now. I feel fear right now. And they say, oh, what about? Well, in this conversation, you know, you can be careful how you say it, right? And so they don't feel like you're pouncing on them, but you make I statements, for example. But you label out loud. And a label is never an interpretation. It's never a judgment about the experience. So you label out loud and say, well, I'm feeling resistance right now. And, you know, I wanted to explore it. And part of my mindfulness practice is explore it. And I'd like you to know about it. And I've done that with people. I don't know if I've ever told them I had resistance, but sometimes I've said, you know, I feel angry right now, or I feel afraid right now. And I'd like you to know that that's part of what's happening for me as I'm trying to sort out how to have this conversation with you. Mindfulness out loud. Honesty. I call honesty is mindfulness out loud. When that's happening to you, are you relatively calm at that time, or is it just this kind of street consciousness?
Sorry.
Are you relatively calm at that point when you have these random thoughts? So the question was, she was asking what to do with random crazy thoughts that just seem to come on their own. They have nothing to do with the past and the present, but just seem to arise. How do you practice with that?
I think I'm calm.
Because it's very common when people meditate to get somewhat calm. It's sometimes. And when they get calm, the dreamlike quality of the mind gets released, and there can be, and also the mind sometimes gets a little bit sleepy at that time, and then a lot of random thoughts or images can just surface and arise, and sometimes if the mind is calm, it also is a little bit complacent. The effort there to practice mindfulness is let up a little bit, and so the effort is not there to keep you on track, and so there's more space for these random thoughts to bubble up. There's two things you can do, a lot of things you can do, but one of them is to redouble your effort at getting concentrated, to develop concentration, go back and count your breath or be with your breath, or use labeling in a very concentrated way, but do something to bring more energy of concentration into the practice, to bring you to a deeper level of calm or concentration than that layer where that kind of random bubbly thoughts might happen. Sometimes it's helpful to get up and do walking meditation if that happened. Sometimes changing the context of the way you meditate can break the trance of that kind of thinking. And if the reason it's happening is that you're really sleepy, like sometimes it happens to me if I'm meditating late in the evening, and I'll redouble my effort, I'll do all these efforts to try to kind of deal with it, and sometimes nothing works, and my mind gets actually kind of quite really elaborate, you know, I think I'm following my breath, I'm convinced I'm following my breath, but somehow in the middle of following breath, there's this huge play going on of characters and people and flowing in and out, and it's somehow so camouflaged in the breath that I think I'm with my breath, but there's this like amazing thing going on. And so, so then I go to sleep.
Is that it? When that's happening to me, I think it's partly sleepiness.
Is it? Yeah. So maybe some people need sleep more than they need meditation. Yes?
Two things I go. Something happened, and at the time I thought it was just wonderful that that was happening. I felt in my mind, of course. But now I think maybe it was not so good that it happened. This was after Tony always talked about how it is looking into your mind and getting a more insightful thinking rather than your regular daily thinking. And at some sitting, I had the feeling like for a couple of seconds my mind was clear and detached, and it was wonderful. But then I realized that was happening. Of course, it slipped away. And not only it slipped away, but it has now affected me in a worse way, that whenever I sit, like is it going to happen? Am I going to be able to you know, until then, I was just happily labeling and sitting and labeling and going with the flow. Now that that has happened once, and it happened not as strong as that time, but it happened one more time. And now it's a big disturbance for me.
Yes. So those of you who didn't hear it was she's been practicing this for some time and being present and labeling and going along her merry way, and then out of the blue came this experience of great calm and clarity and stillness, and it lasted until she noticed it, and then I guess she got self-conscious or kind of something happened. It's when you often you notice these things, you get kind of excited or something, and it went away. And now she's worse off than she was before, and she thinks, you know, this was a, you know, she's heard that these things might be good for thing to happen in practice, but she thinks she's worse off than before because now she expects it to happen or wants it to happen or measures her experiences by, you know, this having happened, and she tasted the forbidden fruit, and now she's, you know, been kicked out of Eden, and she can't, you know, she knows what she lost. Is that approximately what you said? Close enough? This is classic. How many people in this room have had something similar to that? Make you feel better? Or worse?
But what do you do? I mean, do you just detach?
So you have to realize it's really common for this attitude to arise. The tendency to think that way, to relate to that experience with judgment or clinging or wanting or expectation or disappointment when it doesn't happen again, is a common human tendency. It probably happens in other areas of your life, and it's now happening here. And if spiritual life or meditative life is very important for you, it's sometimes more poignant when it happens here. But take it as a good sign. And take it as a sign that now you're becoming more conscious of how your mind works. And you have a chance to try to resolve and deal with this. Deal with the issues of expectation, of judgment, of measuring yourself, of all these things. And that's really a big part of where the work really is dealing with these things. And the experience of calm that you've had has given you an opportunity to deal with your reactions to it. And then once you've dealt with those reactions and responses, then next time it happens, it's less likely to be triggered, and maybe it'll last a little longer. So I would take it as a good sign. Just, you know, give yourself a pat on the back, and good, and you're right on track. Yes, Bingo.
You used to tell a lovely story about the long forks. Can you tell the long forks?
Well, it's been a while ago, but there's a story about... I guess someone dies and wakes up, whatever you do after you die, and in this place where there's this amazingly beautiful feast, decked out with this beautiful feast of food and every possible lovely, fantastic food, and all these beautiful people for company and music and beautiful views, and it just seems, you know, like paradise. And the person says, you know, where am I? I mean, is this, did I wake up in heaven? And the dinner partner says, no, this is hell. And how can this be hell? And he looks down at the place setting, and there's these really, 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 really long forks. That's kind of like a preschool thing to say, really, really, really. It's, you know... We're affected by who we hang out with. and so, you know, the person looks around and sees that people are really trying really hard to somehow get that food, the delicious food, into their mouth, and they can't get it in because these forks are so big, and, you know, how do you get it in? And, you know, and it's because the person's horrified. Well, I'm going to starve. How am I going to eat? You know, it's really tempting food, and I can't get it in my mouth. And so and the person next to him said, no, this is not heaven. This is hell. And heaven is exactly the same. But there, everyone knows to feed the person across the table with the forks. So we're all in it together, and it helps if we cooperate rather than just think for ourselves, about ourselves. Yes?
Was there ever a time when it's appropriate to say no instead of yes?
Yes.
I mean, in the context of a meditation.
Oh, sure, it can be. Sometimes it's given, it's like one of the last strategies, and all the other strategies have failed. You say no. Like, for example, when the mind is just keeps repeatedly thinking about the same thing over and over again, you can't let go of it, or keeps being in distracted thoughts over and over and over and over again, and you tried everything else to, you know, to be with it. And you, sometimes it's useful just to say no, just absolutely firmly, kind of like Manjushri sword, saying no. Because sometimes the mind is like a toddler, you know, a little kid, and sometimes you have to say no. You have to put limits and say that's not the way it's going to be. No. And so. Yes, sometimes a no is appropriate. So it's nice to be back. And it's nice to see all of you that I've seen before so many times. And I see a number of new faces here. And I'm very happy to see people I haven't seen before and welcome you to our community. And hope you all feel welcome here to come as you wish. For those of you who are new, I realize that meditators sometimes, you know, kind of quiet people. We're basically nice people. It just takes a while to get to know us because we sometimes are quiet. Thank you all, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.